The following KOPN podcast is made possible by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please consider a donation to listener-supported community radio, KOPN. You can donate securely on our website at kopn.org.
You're listening to 89.5 FM, KOPN Columbia, Mid-Missouri source for in-depth news, diverse talk, and music of the world. It's more than radio, it's community radio, on the web at kopn.org. Welcome to Thought Crime Radio. We are voices for the human rights of babies. This is Janelle, and I'm solo in the studio right now waiting for my co-host Rich to hobble up the stairs. We have a very exciting show for you today. We're both very excited to have Gloria LeMay on with us today. Gloria LeMay is a midwife from Canada, and I'd like to read something off of her website today, which was, she said, "I have never done anything gross to another human being just to show a teacher my skills, and that is a good feeling in my soul." And we're going to talk about that, because we're going to talk about cesarean birth. And as soon as Rich gets up here, kind of excited about this, because Rich happened to have had a surgery on Saturday, abdominal surgery, And so we're going to talk about his experience as a man. And because every time he was, when I was giving him a ride home and he was straining to get upstairs and sit down, I would say, well, just think, if you had just given birth to a baby, you'd have to take care of a baby as well. And that's a big issue in our medical system, that surgical birth is a major surgical operation. Cesarean birth is major abdominal surgery. And I think to get Gloria on here, I'm just going to go ahead and bring Gloria on, and then Rich is going to join us when he can, when he gets up here. Let me see here. Hey, Gloria. Oh, I think I lost Gloria.
No, I'm here, Janelle.
Oh,
can you
yay,
hear me?
Yay, yay. I can hear you now. Cool.
Great.
Hey, I'm so excited to have you on with us today.
Well, I'm very pleased to be here.
I don't know who in our audience knows you, but you are a birth advocate. You advocate for natural birth, home birth. You are a very strong intactivist. And Rich and I have talked a lot about surgical amputation, circumcision the first couple of weeks of our show. And you, one of the things on your site that you had was really interesting to me, because I'd like to sort of tie the cesarean surgery into this. And you said that on your gravestone that you wanted to read Gloria LeMay, birth attendant and mother, she spoke up for babies. And I'd really like to talk about that. I'd like to focus our conversation about, when we're talking about the surgical birth, also about how it affects mothers, but how it affects babies as well. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I'm just listening to what you're saying. it's I just feel like, from the point of view of a culture, how you treat and speak up for and advocate for the smallest, most vulnerable people, and this could be people at the very beginning of life when they have no voice, and also at the end of life when you're old and, you know, losing your faculties and not able to fend for yourself, how we treat people at these places in our lives is really indicative of how we're doing. You know, it's not the gross national product, and it's not the how many cars you have in the garage. It's how you treat your babies and how you treat your old people. That says what's really going on inside of you. Like, all of those other things can't really be a measure of how you're doing as an individual or as a society in general. And so you can see that we have no priority for either of those spectrums of life, like either of those ends of life. You know, babies are basically handled like a piece of meat in the hospital, and they're, you know, wrapped up like little burritos and taken away to have medications and surgeries and all kinds of things without any consent on their part. And, of course, at the other end of life, you know, nobody really wants to spend the time and energy that it would really take to have their old grandma or their grandpa have a dignified and contributing end to their life. So these are failures on our part to really manifest the possibilities that we are. You know, as a species, we have so much that we should be able to have this excess energy to actually look and see what the people with no voices really have to say, and what taking care of them would contribute to everybody else. So that's basically having that quest inside of myself, that's the kind of gravestone I would like to have, you know, looking back on a life that I would have been proud to live. If I live my life speaking up for babies, I think it doesn't get much better than that, you know.
I totally agree.
Absolutely. Hi, Gloria. This is Rich Winkle. How are you doing?
Hey, nice to talk to you.
Yeah. We
go ahead.
Well, your points about old people and babies are well taken. One of the things that we're stressing here on this radio show is how babies, how they are treated, affects their future behavior and their future lives, and actually contributes to the overall culture of barbarism, which mm-hmm. pervades this country.
Definitely. It's an interesting thing for me to really be involved with the men's health issues around keeping penises intact and having men be whole and healthy, and the efforts that men are making to restore their foreskins and stop circumcision from happening in the first place. And then to be involved in the childbirth movement and see all of the women who are suffering from having major abdominal surgery when they have their babies, which is called cesarean. And it dawned on me one day that, oh my gosh, most 30-year-olds in the United States who are in a marriage relationship or a couple are trying to have a fulfilling sex life with a woman who's had a scar across the top of her pubic hair and very often says, I can't bear my husband's weight on my belly since I had my cesarean, that scar tissue is extremely sensitive and the woman feels very vulnerable for the rest of her life with having the weight of a man on her belly. And then the man that she's having a sex life with has had his foreskin amputated at birth, so he has a scar on his penis that leads to a lack of sensitivity and difficulties in making love. And so here are these two otherwise healthy 30-year-olds that have had outside surgery completely alter their experience of their sexuality. And, you know, life is very tough for human beings. I mean, nobody gets a free ride through life where it's all just lightness and dancing. I mean, it's very, very hard. There's incredible things that people run up against as adversities. And having a rich sexual life is one of those God-given gifts that we're all entitled to that kind of makes the path a bit easier. And it's almost impossible for American couples to have that with all the surgery that's going on, all the unnecessary surgery. And so that combination, you know, that we had 30 years ago, we had an 80% cesarean or 80% circumcision rate for baby boys in the United States, and that's dropping every year, and we are getting somewhere, and I think we're getting somewhere with even more velocity nowadays. But nevertheless, we've left a legacy for the generation right now who's 30 to 50 years old that their entire sexuality has been warped by cultural practices that they didn't agree to.
So they're non-consenting, uninformed
mm-hmm.
babies when these things were done to them.
Mm-hmm. And it's permanent.
And there's also sort of a covert, I mean, there's a denial in our society that the baby is fully present being and that it matters, that people believe still that they can do whatever they wish to a baby in front of a baby, and then it doesn't matter because babies don't remember, and babies don't feel, and babies don't think.
And babies have no rights. There's a huge amount of institutional inertia or secrecy or something going on. There seems to be an agenda here where medicine seems to be obsessed with hurting children somehow. I don't know.
That's pretty bizarre.
Well, it is bizarre when you think about it. I mean,
these are caring people that really want the best for a baby.
Well, all I can say is they're miseducated, okay?
I'm being Rich's devil's advocate right now.
Well, what seems to be the only possible answer to why that would be happening has got to be a profit motive. I mean, I can't imagine that there's any other reason to continue circumcising in great numbers in certain pockets in the country than that people are just on a mad money quest. And the same, you know, about cesarean birth, it's got to be, you know, either fear of litigation or, you know, some money incentive is there all the time. Everything that happens with newborn babies. I mean, even things like giving erythromycin ointment in the eyes of the baby, the antibiotic cream that's put in the baby's eyes. Mm. I've just had a visit from a midwife from Australia, and she was trained in Britain, and she just shook her head that it's possible that we treat every newborn baby in North America with antibiotic eye ointment. She's like, why? Like, why would you do that? I mean, why not just treat babies who have eye infections the same as you would any other child in society?
Seems logical.
Why would you do a massive antibiotic administration to every child in the country when so few get an eye infection? And this, again, we don't even question it because it just becomes part of our culture, and we don't even know what the possibilities would be around that. But now that we're hooked up via internet with other countries, we're starting to see that, oh, this is just something that happens in North America. Great Britain, Australia, other Western countries do not do this, and there's absolutely no increase in blindness or anything else. It's, you know, just when a baby gets an eye infection, you treat it, period. So there's many things that happen in North America that you can see big pharmaceutical companies behind it, or doctors getting used to making an extra $10,000 a year off doing their circumcisions, and they just keep on doing it because that's paying their kids' college education or something. And there seems to be something missing as far as morality goes.
Yes, this is definitely a commodification of birth.
Can you say more about that?
Well, I had a couple here today, and we were talking about what to expect with their childbirth experience. And what I explained to them was that I wouldn't be doing anything to them or for them, or avoiding doing anything to them or for them, that I wouldn't do exactly the same treatment for my own daughter were she having a baby. And what I said to them was, you know, that doesn't mean I might not make a mistake. I may make the wrong advice to you in hindsight, you know, that we could have done things differently and it would have worked out better. But you can be assured it wouldn't be different than exactly the same mistake I would make with my own daughter if I was making a mistake. So that's the best I can do, is give you the exact same care that I would give to my family. And of course, you know, that's a nice thing to say to a couple, and you know, I'm sure they appreciate that. But then I said to them, and the reason that I'm telling you this and the reason that my actions are that way is not for your sake. It's for my own sake, so that I can look at myself in the mirror. You know, it's a selfish thing for me to treat people that way, because I want to be able to live with myself. And I couldn't live with myself if I did one thing for your family that I wouldn't do for my own family. And to me, that's the ultimate in ethics, is that you stay true to yourself with the ultimate goal of you got to live with yourself. And, you know, there's not enough drugs or liquor I could drink or take that would help me to live with myself if I did something different for another person's family. But then I don't work in a system. I don't work with governing bodies or, you know, someone who could take my license away. I'm not a licensed practitioner, and I don't belong to groups that would throw me out if I made a wrong move or I didn't do what they told me to do. So I really am, like, working very independently. And, you know, if I could find some group that would allow me to work that independently, I'd probably join them. But so far I haven't been able to find one, because when we amalgamate together into things like the American Medical Association or the American Academy of Pediatrics, then it becomes about control, and you have to control your members from doing anything too stupid, and it gets tighter and tighter control, and you also protect people who are living within those guidelines but really are not very nice to small people or birthing women or old people, and you protect them because pretty soon it becomes the survival of the organization itself rather than really treating the public like first do no harm.
And I think that that's really what's happening in the larger systems. And I'm kind of interested in what you were saying about what you told this couple.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have somebody who might be calling in here. When my ex, I went through family practice residency and an obstetrics residency with my ex-husband, and I've actually written a paper about this called When the Doctor Says, this is, if you were my wife or my daughter, this is what I would recommend. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's scientifically based.
Yeah.
So the same thing that you mentioned, that you used in a totally different context, because you only want to do what you can live with. That's what I've noticed that the hospital system caregivers are also feeling, like, because their training is different. So because I saw in this obstetric training how he just became so different in his thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so both sides will use that. I found that really interesting. Because I think, isn't that what we all really, really want? I mean, who wants to be a baby abuser? Or who really wants to be someone who harms a woman medically or physically? Right?
It's remarkable that that medicine is so effective at brainwashing their doctors. There's some kind of self-perpetuating mythology. Just terrible things happening to babies by people who, in any other circumstance, would not do it.
So, hey, Gloria, what would be your advice to women to be able to discern when they hear that from the midwife and they hear it from the OB? What can women do to really discern for themselves what's true for them?
Well, one of the good things in childbirth is that you get a dress rehearsal of your birth by going to prenatal visits. So if you go to prenatal visits with your midwife or with your physician, that will give you a very good idea of what it's going to be like the day of the birth. So if they're in a hurry and they want you out of there really quickly, that's not going to change on the day of your birth. If they're warm and welcoming and providing you with lots of patient listening, they're also going to listen to your needs at your birth. If they're organized and always on time for their appointments, they're going to be people that you will be able to reach on their pager when you call them. You know, it's like there's just this, whenever I have talked to people who have had a very upsetting bad birth experience and I go through what it was like when they were getting prenatal care from that person, there was always places where they were given the hint about how it was going to be at the birth by how it was going to be, or how it actually was in the prenatal visit. And I think people need to be more wakeful and watchful about that. You know, like, you can't just say, oh, yeah, well, I knew my doctor had no time for me and was really, really busy, but I thought he would be different at my birth. You know, it's kind of like trying to change your husband. They don't change easily.
I was just thinking, this is like dating and marriage.
Yeah.
What you see is what you get.
Exactly. Like, wake up, women.
Right, Rich?
You know, and I actually find, I mean, when men come along with their wives, I really feel good that that woman has someone with a better BS detector in the room with her, because women tend to give everybody the benefit of the doubt. But men don't. Men are very straightforward about, no, this is BS. I don't like the vibe of that person. And so I'm always happy to see the men, you know, taking their protector role even in the pregnancy visits, because it's time well spent. And this couple that came to see me this morning, I was really talking to the mother about her nutrition at 29 weeks, that she needs to lean more towards protein foods. She's sort of been, you know, angling a little bit towards sugary type things. And so I went through that very carefully with her. And the father said, he said, I'm so glad I'm here today listening to this, because I'm the one that gets up in the morning and gets the breakfast things ready. And so if you don't want her eating cereals and milk, you want her eating eggs and toast or a grilled cheese sandwich or something that's more protein, then I'm the one who will be fixing that, and I'll make sure that happens. And I was like, oh, I love you. Mm-hmm. This is great.
And then he has in his pocket, too, well, Gloria said this. When the mother says, oh, I want
exactly,
some cereal.
Exactly.
No, Gloria said this.
Well, her little ears actually perked right up, because I think that pregnant women do have an inner knowledge of what they need to eat. And then, you know, our busy lifestyles, it just becomes like, okay, let's grab a box of cereal and a cup of milk. And it's not really what the body needs, but it's just kind of like, okay, well, now I've done breakfast and it's a quick breakfast. So it was really good to have that conversation with them. And I was pointing out to them that it's really not about survival, because the vast majority of babies in North America, no matter what the mother eats, no matter what she smokes, no matter what she does, the vast majority do well. Because when you live in a rich country, it's pretty impossible to not get enough nutrition. But what we're talking about is the best baby possible. So we're not talking about survival. We're talking about actually having the opportunity to grow a baby that does excellent things in school and has every possibility of living out its potential as a human being. And so that sort of makes the mother, you know, I mean, she doesn't have to feel guilty or bad or wrong about what's happened in the past. She can begin today going forward just knowing that she's optimizing things for her baby rather than worrying about her baby's survival.
Can you address briefly the real possibility of issues with nutrition, though, in this country, because isn't that supposed to be related to preeclampsia and things like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, scientifically, the only two things that we have ever been able to prove with properly done studies and data in obstetrics is that you can produce a better baby, a baby that will have more of a chance of having a good life, by doing one of two things or both of these things. One is improving the nutrition of the mother, and the second thing is providing more social support for the mother. So improving the nutrition of the mother, the research that was actually done in this area was done in the late 1940s in post-war Montreal, Quebec. And what happened there was that they had many Catholic families with large numbers of children who were poverty-stricken. They lived in a very poor part of Montreal, and their babies would be born prematurely and not do very well. And a nutritionist named Agnes Higgins asked for a government grant, and she asked to have a soup kitchen that had been there for during the Depression. They had these soup kitchens for hobos that were traveling around the country trying to find work. And so she asked the government if she could take over one of these soup kitchens and provide a nutritional program for these mothers that were carrying babies, like might be their sixth, seventh, eighth baby, in their pregnancies. And the women who came to her would get two eggs, an orange, and a quart of milk. And in those days, the milk was not homogenized. So they would get a quart of whole milk with the cream on the top that you would have to shake up. And homogenizing really changes the fat globules in the milk. So that's an important point, that the milk that women are drinking today is nothing like the proteins of non-homogenized milk. So what was happening was these women who had seven premature babies, low birth weight babies, they also had to agree that they would not feed this food to their older children. They would eat it for themselves, for their unborn babies. And that's an important thing when you get into large numbers of pregnancies, is that the women will give the best food to their living children, mm-hmm. and they won't nourish themselves and the unborn baby as well. So for the first time, these women started having 8-pound full-term babies. And that research that she has done has been redone several times, and it holds up through retesting, that improving the nutrition of the mother with some with a vitamin C fruit, like an orange, and those protein sources of whole milk and eggs, I mean, that's very minimal. You know, for a pregnant woman to just add that little bit to her diet can make a huge difference in the potential for her child. And I think one of the problems with nutrition counseling, I mean, very few practitioners do any at all. I mean, I find, I talk to pregnant women all the time about what they're eating, and people always say, you're the only person who's ever mentioned anything about what to eat. Mm. And I'm like, why aren't other people doing this? But I think for one thing, it gets boring. You know, if you're going around telling people, drink whole milk and have two eggs and an orange, after a while, you're bored out of your tree. And secondly, so few people will actually do it. Like, people just nod and smile, and then they go back and get their Snickers bar and chips or something. So it's discouraging work sometimes. And I think being a private practitioner where people are paying me out of their own pocket helps, because I don't know about you, but I take a lot of advice all day long, and it just goes in one ear and out the other. But boy, if I pay somebody to give me advice, I really mm-hmm. listen hard. Yeah. So it just seems to be one of those human foibles that free advice is about worth that.
And I also think that has to do with choice, because right now, you know, people will go to practitioners because their insurance pays for it. Mm-hmm. And that's not only like medical, but like other forms, you know, like massage and chiropractors,
right.
and things like that. And they will do what their insurance company will pay for, even if it doesn't really seem to be what they want. They don't check it out.
Oh, yeah. I don't really understand the American system so much, because I'm in Canada, and, you know, our system,
we don't understand it either.
It has a lot of shortfalls, too. But
well, my point was, is when somebody's, if you're going to pay $100 to go to the chiropractor, mm-hmm. if you're paying it out of your pocket, you make sure that that's what you're going to do. Or if you're going to the doctor and you're going to pay $100.
You're motivated.
Yeah,
sure.
Whatever it is that you're going to, if you choose alternative care or traditional medical care, if you pay for it out of your pocket, you make sure that it's what you want and what you really need. Instead of,
right.
Well, they pay for it, so I'll go do this physical therapy thing. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's sort of the attitude here. Yeah, I'll go to a nutritionist, but, you know,
But getting back to the nutrition issue, this pattern continues after birth when, you know, at least here in the United States, they hand out free samples of infant formula.
Do they still do that in your
yes,
hospital?
Absolutely.
They do it here locally. I just heard about it a few weeks ago.
And
you have to be a baby-friendly hospital, and it takes a lot. Most hospitals, there's there's too much interest from the pharmaceutical company that makes the formula, and it's free, and they hand out diapers and wet ones and bags and all sorts of things.
It gets worse, too. If you go to the grocery store, you can go down the infant food aisle and pick up a gallon of specially formulated water for reconstituting infant formula. And what makes this water so special is that it has fluoride in it, extra fluoride.
Oh, my gosh.
Can you believe that?
That is so scary.
It is scary. It's worse than quackery. It's child abuse.
I read the there's a incredible email list for lactation consultants called LactNet, and I originally got into it because they have a searchable archive that has all this incredible information from lactation consultants across the United States and around the world. And, no matter what kind of breastfeeding issue you have, you can go in there and look at their past posts on that subject. So it's an incredible resource, and I ended up subscribing to the newsletter, and it really is an eye-opener. It's things I just don't know about or I just don't see. Like, I mean, everyone in my work breastfeeds their baby, not as even a question. Like, what else would we do? I mean, there's just absolutely no other possibility. And I have a mother right now who has a little boy with a very severe cleft lip and palate. And the doctors told her when she presented him at the hospital, they said, well, you know, it'll be impossible for you to breastfeed him because he has this opening in his palate, and part of extracting the breast milk is you have to form a suction with the mouth, and he can't do that because he's all open inside there. But that just meant that she started pumping like a fiend, and she does bottle feed him, but she bottle feeds him her own fresh breast milk. Mm-hmm. And the doctors at the hospital just can't believe her that she's able to produce milk. And she's like, but I carry him all the time on my skin, and he's with me every moment, and of course I have to feed him breast milk. Like, what else could I do? And so even under terrible circumstances, there's just no option for feeding formula like that. One of our lactation consultants here says, I always give people the choice. Do they want to breastfeed their baby or feed crap in a can?
That's exactly
and
right.
I just think that's the way to put it, you know, so people understand. You only have two choices, breast milk or crap in a can.
Is this LactNet, LactNet.org?
LactNet, all one word.
And so anybody can go there?
Yes.
.org?
It's a Yahoo group.
Oh, I see, okay.
Yeah, I can forward it to you, Rich, so
okay.
You can see it, yeah.
You know, I had a friend who breastfed her baby. Well, she finger-fed him for 18 months. He'd actually latched twice in 18 months, and she finger-fed him and did everything possible so that he could have that milk. And that's the commitment that it takes sometimes.
Really?
Yeah. Well, we need to take a little bit of a break and do a couple of announcements. And then I want to get back to talking about cesarean. And we did have someone call in. We usually don't take calls till the last part of the show, and we could take some calls now if you'd like to take some, Gloria.
Sure.
Okay, so if you need an attorney or a civil matter and are low income, you may be eligible to get help from Mid-Missouri Legal Services. Matters for assistance may include domestic relations, landlord-tenant issues, welfare, unemployment, Medicaid, and more. More information at 442-0116 or toll-free at 1-800-568-4931.
And the Heart of Missouri Chorus are members of Sweet Adeline's International, a worldwide educational organization of women singers who perform four-part a cappella harmony. The Hearts are seeking women's singers who have a good ear for pitch and who are interested in performing and the challenge of ongoing musical education. More education and more information, I should say, at homchorus.coin.org or by phone at 573-446-8568.
Okay, so we would like to take calls. If you'd like to call in, it's 443-8255, 443-TALK. And in the meantime, I really wanted to continue with the breastfeeding theme, and I really wanted to talk about your experience with having surgery. Like today, you had surgery, abdominal surgery on Friday, and if you were a mother today, you would be released from the hospital with a newborn.
Well, I have a hard enough time just getting up and down the stairs. They poked three holes in my belly and sewed up a hernia. They used laparoscopic surgery, so they used one of these metal snakes, and the actual cuts were fairly minor. I can't imagine what it would be like to have a cesarean scar on my belly and trying to cope with that at the same time I'm trying to deal with a newborn baby. It would be crazy.
Because you'd be sent home. Most likely the baby would not have been able to latch much because you were out of it Friday and Saturday. And like the babies, could we address that, Gloria, how the impact of surgical birth on the mother-baby relationship?
Well, it's not, in the case of a cesarean, it's not just the cesarean scar on the abdomen. In order to get to where the uterus is, the surgeon has to go through six layers of tissue, muscle, fascia. It's not just one layer. And the uterus is in the most central part of the body. Like, to get to it, you have to actually peel the bladder off of the uterus.
Wow.
So you peel it off, and I always think of it sort of like, if you bought a new coat from the store and the pocket was sewn onto the coat, and then for some reason you took a seam ripper and you had to take the pocket carefully off the coat and sew it back on, you know very well that you would never quite get it again the same as it was when you put it on. And one of the things to notice in our culture is that when you walk into a big, do you call it drugstore or pharmacy in the States?
Either one, but more pharmacy nowadays.
Okay.
Because we don't do drugs in America.
If you walk into a big pharmacy, you'll notice that every year that line of attends pads and incontinent items gets longer and longer and longer. When I was a little girl and would go into the drugstore, first of all, you never saw condoms anywhere that was in sight. They were always asked for behind the counter, and you had to be a married man to get them. And there were no incontinence supplies at all. Like, I don't know, when this started becoming popular, but it sort of coincided with this cesarean epidemic 20 years before. And so when you peel someone's bladder off their uterus and then reattach it once the surgery is done, that bladder never sits quite right in there again. And often women who've had cesareans, every time they sneeze or laugh or do anything when they're 55 years old, they're peeing their pants. So nobody tells you about this when you're giving an informed consent for this major abdominal surgery, that it's not just your abdomen. It's way inside there. And
I've seen surgeries where they actually turn the uterus inside out.
They pull the uterus up out of the body, and it's held on by very firm ligaments, like the round ligaments that hold the uterus to the spine are under incredible torsion if you actually lift it up and bring it out onto the woman's abdomen. But if it was, as much as that's a trauma to the body, if I was having a cesarean, I would want them to do that because that's the best way for them to view how they're doing the repair. If they don't have the uterus up and out of the body onto the abdomen, where it's definitely not supposed to ever be, then they're suturing blind. Mm. And they're basically down in a tight hole trying to repair a piece of furniture or something. It's a very difficult way to do the repair. So
can I sort of insert something here, sort of to give our listeners a comparison? So you're talking about a surgical birth, and we're talking with Gloria LeMay, midwife extraordinaire from Canada. And in, at the time that this is going on, what you're talking about right now, her uterus is out because they're repairing. In a home birth, can you describe what's going on at this point?
Well, first of all, at a home birth, you would never be doing a cesarean.
My point is I wanted to talk about mother-baby connection. So at this point, the woman is drugged and she's in surgery and the baby has been taken out and is probably with the neonatologist to make sure that it's okay.
And the baby's drugged too.
And the cord blood is, the cord's been severed, of course. And so they're repairing her. Contrast that with same time period with a mother, like first 20 minutes or first 10 minutes.
Well, I guess it comes down to that distinction between a delivery and a birth. So when people are doing deliveries, it tends to be a lot like a pizza, you know, where the pizza man brings the thing to your house and then you never give him back the pizza. You take the pizza in your kitchen and you divide it up and you do important things to it and prepare for, you know, what's going to happen to the pizza. But in a birth, it's a completely separate thing. And the mother pushes her baby out, ideally into her husband's hands, because the two of them have mm-hmm. made that baby together. It's thrilling to catch a baby, and any four-year-old can do it. There's nothing to it. The baby just comes out of the mother. So the father would receive the baby into his hands, and there's nowhere to take the baby to because the baby is still firmly tethered to the mother through the umbilical cord. So the mother would take the baby normally and just bring it right up to her heart, and at some point in the first 20 minutes, usually one or both of the parents look to see if it's a boy or a girl. Hopefully the attendants are able to be quiet and still in the space of ecstasy, and mother and baby are looking good, you keep your big mouth shut and let the family just have the fun of falling in love with their new baby.
And can you tell, like, the baby's okay without touching the baby, taking the temperature, all those things?
Yeah, the main thing with telling the well-being of the baby is what color is the skin, and often they can turn scary shades of purple to blue and then pink. So you have to give them about 60 seconds to really adjust to outside life. What you don't want to see is pale babies. And
so a purple baby is better than a pale baby?
Purple is better than pale, yes. Purple means there's circulation happening. And
the cord's intact.
And the cord helps to balance the baby and helps to close off the shunts in the heart and all of the complex things that happen when you change over from being a belly button breather to being a lung breather. And it's a very miraculous process, and unmedicated babies are ideally suited to do it, just like any other mammal. And so the baby's on the mother's skin. Sometimes the mother will be in a water tub, and the attendant should make sure that she's kept nice and warm. And sometimes she'll be on a bed, and then you just make sure that she's dry and comfortable in her bed. But disturbing as little as possible that first half hour after the birth. Unbeknownst to the mother and out of sight of everyone, her uterus, which has been the size of a small watermelon when the baby was inside there, reduces down to the size of a grapefruit just below her belly button by about a half an hour after birth. And that process is painless, and it's something that anyone is unaware of unless you specifically are looking for it by putting your hands on her belly. And
but hopefully the baby's laying there.
Which?
Hopefully the baby is lying there.
On her belly?
Yeah.
Yes. Or beside her on the bed if she's on the bed. Mm-hmm. Like, they're just close together.
Mm-hmm.
And so the mother's blissfully unaware of all that, but after about a half an hour, she'll say, "Oh, I feel like pushing again. What's all this about?" And then she'll grunt and bear down, and the placenta will come out. But for that first half hour, the baby has been, like I say, balancing his blood supply and balancing all the changes in his body by being linked up to the mother in that way.
And getting well aerated, highly oxygenated blood, as well as you know, both the baby and the mother are awash in love hormones at this point.
Exactly. Yeah.
Making eye contact, cooing, touching.
Yes, this is a crucial time for a baby.
If they're
even
disrupted,
even things like, I mean, for me, it's a never-ending exercise in looking to see how we disturb the mother and baby getting together. And even things like putting a hat on the baby is an interference, because then the mother isn't sniffing and smelling this little newborn head.
Well, thank you for saying that.
Yeah, and, you know, anything that distracts the mother, any jokes or comments, or even saying things like, oh, congratulations, you were so brave, you know, all these things that midwives like to say. All of those things are ways of getting the attention off the baby and back onto the very special person who delivered the baby. So you have to be very careful to, for me, it's like a quest to be as silent and as visible as possible. I sort of see myself as, you know, if you go to a public swimming pool in the summer, you really don't want to see or hear from the lifeguard unless there's some really good reason. So you don't want him coming over and chatting you up and asking you questions or anything. You just want him in his chair there, completely anonymous, completely invisible. And then if some child is in trouble and drowning in the bottom of the pool, you want him to jump off his ladder and know what to do. But for the most part, he should just be invisible to you, and you should not be even slightly concerned with the personality of the lifeguard. And
so you don't really need him coming by and going, oh, you're doing so good there.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah.
Keep it up. That was a good dive.
Yeah, it's, you know, that we tend to be, a lot of times people who attend home births have taken a lot of their training from being in the hospital, or a lot of their what they feel is appropriate or inappropriate from the hospital. And for sure, I think we took all these little knitted hats out of the hospital.
And the little blue bulbs.
Well, I remember one time someone showing me a photograph of their stillborn baby. They had a little baby that died in utero at about 30 weeks pregnant. And sadly, the baby was born not alive. And they had taken a photograph of the baby, and even that little dead baby had a hat on its head. And I was like, what are they doing? Like, why would they put a hat on your baby's head? If you want to take a picture of your baby to remember him, you don't really want him with a toucan. Like, everybody looks kind of silly with a toucan. And yet, around the hospital, if they see a baby with a bare head, it becomes this manic need to put a hat on everything that, you know, has a tiny head. So we do these things very rotely without even thinking. And I think it's time for people to start questioning some of these routine practices.
Absolutely.
And many of these interventions serve as vectors for staph infection, you know, hospital.
Yes, yeah.
Especially removing the baby from the mother, not allowing its skin to become colonized with the mother's skin bugs, you know, for which the mother's breast milk will confer immunity just automatically. So much of this is just about trusting nature. Nature has this all figured out.
Yeah.
So, Gloria, do you get do you have a hard time with people who don't understand what you're talking about when you, because I mean, the hats are cute. It's so simple. You know, it's not a big deal. That's sort of the mentality here, right? Because I tend to get that. Because I'm a big advocate of no hands, no talking, no singing, no touch hats, all that. And people think it's kind of nitpicky. But you're making it sound really critical.
Well, we just don't know, do we? And I think, for me, I've had the blessing of having had very beautiful home births myself. So I don't need to go to somebody else's birth to get my thrills around that area. Mm-hmm. So I can be a still observer. Although, you know, there's always this little part of me that just loves getting attention. I call her the little three-year-old inside of me. But I keep her under a very tight chain because, you know, I'm 62 years old and I think it's time for me to grow out of that. So
you're making a really good point here, and that is something that I've noticed since in home births and in hospital births, is that people really try to glom on to babies when all a baby needs is to be in the mother's arms.
Yeah.
And mothers and fathers need to protect their babies.
Both psychologically and physiologically, physically.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I have a very wonderful friend who worked with me for 14 years. We did midwifery together for 14 years, and she never had any children of her own, but she was extremely sensitive to everything about the baby's experience. And, you know, if you had a nice, soft, well-washed, well-worn towel that was nice and soft to your hand, she would never allow that to be put on a baby. It had to be flannelette. Like, you just couldn't put terry towel anywhere near the sensitive newborn skin. And, you know, she, in some regards, drove me nuts with things like that, but she was very valuable for me to work with because she really trained me in that kind of sensitivity. And one day we had a birth where the mother had given birth to her baby, and the baby was in her arms and still attached to the cord, but it wasn't really responding or pinking up or having. Another way that you tell the baby is fine is that the baby has flexed legs and arms, like good muscle tone. And so this baby was just kind of laying there limp, and I didn't like the color, and I was not wanting to suction the baby, but I wanted that baby to be a little more in her body. And the mother was just basically holding it and not talking to the baby. So I said to her, talk to your baby and tell her that you're glad she's here. And so the mother sort of looked at me confused, and she started talking to her baby. And, of course, if you just did nothing, the baby would come around. But the baby did come around, and then you think, oh, okay, well, it was the talking. Now, aren't I clever? But anyway, when we were driving home from that birth, Mary said to me, I really feel like you made a mistake by telling her to talk to her baby. And I said, really? Like, what do you mean? I that was so wonderful. I made that baby breathe. And she said, no, Gloria. She said, you talk with your mouth. But she said, that mother was talking to her baby. She was talking with her hands. And when you said that, she was touching her baby and stroking her baby and doing a whole bunch of communication with that baby through her hands. And I just was so pleased that I had this partner who would point that out to me, that just because this woman didn't communicate the same way I communicated didn't mean she wasn't talking to her baby. And so these are the things you learn if you are, you know, around people that you're safe to criticize each other and you're safe to develop each other together. But unfortunately, a lot of times in the birth business, it's such a tough business to grow personally like that, because criticism tends to come in the form of just making you wrong, or, you know, can be very nasty. And so you don't have that safe space to just really be intent on what can we do for these families and how can we bring midwifery back.
Your style of midwifery, I love that, what you've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And we're unfortunately running out of time. We always do, and it always seems to go so fast. We've really enjoyed talking with you and would love to have you back again. I mean, I would love to pick up where you were talking about midwives at the birth and what their needs are and how that gets acted out in the birth.
That's a long topic.
It's one of my favorites.
And also the lack of science in so many of these medical interventions.
Oh, it's all dark ages for sure.
It is. It's dark ages.
Well, we have the tech guys waiting to go on at 6.
So your website is GloriaLeMay.com, correct?
Yes. And I have a blog there, too. Thanks so much.
Anything else you'd like to tell us before you go?
No, just I enjoyed this immensely.
We did, too. Thank you so much, Gloria. We'll be in touch.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.